marching on wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my countrymen, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and falling down deep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe in fighting. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking side me, running down with life, I'm fighting in a fought and died. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on LightResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, tonight we had a meeting in my present hometown of Hamilton, Ontario, and our guest speaker was a man who may become a political prisoner in Canada. He was convicted, along with Your Ward News publisher Leroy St. Germain, of willful promotion of hatred, which is against two privileged groups, in this case Jews and women, in terms of his quarterly community newspaper called Your War News. Anyway, at the talk tonight in Hamilton, which was very well attended despite freezing rain and that's very, very unpleasant weather, Dr. Sears made a comment that I found very helpful. He said in his reading, actually, he was quoting a lesbian writer, Camille Paglia. Now, Camille Paglia may be a lesbian, but she has severely broken with the radical feminists. And in some ways, you might say, is pro-freedom and a traditionalist in some ways. Anyway, Camille Paglia has concluded from her study of history that just before the collapse of major civilizations that she's been able to trace, there is a public transgenderism. That is, men acting as women. Less usually women acting as men, but men acting as women. With bizarre rank sexual behavior. Now, that's an interesting coincidence. And should not be surprising, because by the time that becomes publicly acceptable, a civilization has already lost its way. And when that happens, it might take only the slightest shove for it to collapse. Look at our own. When the very elementary concept of a marriage begins to crumble, I don't mean that people cheat in marriages, and yeah, that's happens, and probably always has happened, probably always will, but when the institution itself is unclear, as it is today. Now, for most religions, even most races, marriage is sort of a relatively simple thing. It's a man and a woman, and it's not a difficult concept. You know, you ask a 10-year-old, what is a marriage? And you probe a little bit, to help the child, kind of frame an answer beyond, let's say, the personal. Well, like mommy and daddy. Okay, well, that's an example of a marriage, but what is a marriage? Well, it's not very hard. A man and a woman, okay? It's not two men, it's not two women, it's not a man and a goat. It's a man and a woman. Well, certainly in Canada and in many parts of Western Europe, that concept has been eroded. Marriage, we now have what is euphemistically called same-sex marriage. Well, it might be a same-sex relationship, but it's not a marriage. But it is legally, in many Western countries, including the Dominion of Canada. And then, of course, there's the issue of what's now called sexual identity. Not sex, but sexual identity. Like, who are you? That used to be very simple. I'm a man or I'm a woman. It was binary. There were two choices. You're one or t'other. Well, now, and I mentioned this on several previous programs, it's up for grabs. In fact, we're told that there are multiple sexualities. In Germany, I believe they recognize 57. So, like Heinz 57. We have, listen to the catalog of the dysfunctional, the LGBTQ, and sometimes there are even more letters, but that'd be lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, queer, and I know the inquiry mind may say, well, isn't queer, we used to call homosexuals? Yeah, and I don't know what it is, how it's different from the others. But there are even more oddities, like questioning. You know, you don't know what you are. There used to be a time when somebody in that situation was simply mentally ill. You're messed up. Yeah. The observation, though, that by the time transgenderism is accepted, the society is on the brink of collapse. Because a society that is no longer united by healthy principles, healthy understandings, is up for grabs. And how long will it be able to protect its borders? Oh, well, should it protect its borders? That, of course, is now a vital debate now going on in the United States, with very significant portions of the Democratic Party echoing sentiments like those of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. A friend of mine refers to her as Alexandria Occasional Cortex. In other words, not much of a brain. But anyway, who says a wall is immoral. Immoral. I suggest, living as she does her in the Bronx, that she get rid of the walls or the doors on her residence. I mean, if a barrier is immoral, surely a door to your residence would be immoral. Your You're excluding somebody. Well, even she is not daft enough, I'm sure, to do that. But when it really is a national debate. Should we have borders? And there are movements in many of our Western countries that say borders are wrong. In Canada, there's a small movement called Open Borders. Or no one is illegal. Well, that means basically no borders. So that's a debate in Europe. And it is better in some countries and worse in others. Very bad in Germany, let's say, and Sweden. The collaborationist governments have permitted hordes of unassimilable, white-hating, Christian-hating people from the third world, mostly from the Islamic world, to invade. In Canada, we have an open border on parts of our shared border with the United States in Quebec and Manitoba, where illegals, but most especially in Quebec, pour across the border. Do we interdict them? Like, stop them? Dare I say it, build a wall. Oh, okay, not too radical. Build a fence. Or at least have soldiers there with bayonets, clearly indicating to the swarthy illegals, no, go back. Go back. No, they're duly processed, even though they've broken the law. And they're on the long way to being judged as to whether they have a valid refugee claim, and in the end, many of them, most of them, will get in. The claim will either be upheld, and the criteria is very loose, or even if it's not upheld, you think, well, there'll be consequence. It's not upheld, so they'll be booted out. Well, not necessarily. There are other ways to get to stay. In fact, just this week, the Canadian government announced that there'll be no more deportations to Haiti. Haiti's in quite a state of riot against a corrupt government and a failing economy and blah, 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 blah. But that's not should not be our concern if the people coming in have come in illegally. Well, I believe there is a connection. When you can't get the basics right, like sex, marriage is a man and a woman, okay? Or sexuality or sexual identity. Well, they're two, male and female. When you can't get those basics right, it's not surprising that you can't get the slightly more complicated things right, like policies that put your country first, without shame. I don't think it's surprising that our government peddles a propaganda of white guilt. In fact, the Canadian government is forever apologizing to one minority or another for alleged historical wrongs, most of which were not wrongs at all. Anyway, I digress a little bit from a very uplifting article by a good friend of mine named Jared Taylor. And Jared's the chief spirit behind what used to be a publication. It's actually now a website and, in a sense, an organization that holds an annual meeting, and it's called American Renaissance. And this is an article by Jared. He's reporting from Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania. And this is it's a pictorial put up by Mike Walsh on his website called This Is Europa. And if you'd like to see it, rather than dictate a long URL, why not email me at paul@paulfromm.com? I'll be glad to pass it on to you. Anyway, this is Jared Taylor's excellent article and very colorful in terms of photos report. Jared Taylor reporting from Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania. I am surrounded by a sea of people, all marching with torches. A chant begins, Lietuva, Lietuva, Lietuva. That's Lithuanian. The chant becomes a roar and then dies away. It is patriotic Lithuanians shouting out the name of their country as they march through the streets of their capital city, Vilnius. We are celebrating the 101st anniversary of the restoration of Lithuanian independence in February 1918. I feel a great surge of emotion as I join the chanting, swept away by the love these people feel for each other and for their land. We march to Cathedral Square, where there must be 100,000 people gathered in the cold to celebrate Independence Day with an outdoor concert of patriotic music that begins with the national anthem. All ages are here, from grandmothers to toddlers, adorable in their onesie, or is that onesie, I'm not sure, snowsuits, waving tiny Lithuanian flags. Later I go with Lithuanian nationalists to a bar where there is mead on tap. My hosts sing patriotic songs late into the night. This was my first torchlight parade, my first Independence Day celebration with European nationalists. It was a stirring, unforgettable occasion. I was invited to Vilnius by a youth organization called Kryptis. On February 15th, I spoke at a conference of identitarians from Poland, Germany, Ukraine, Britain and the United States, and of course Lithuania. It was a very successful first international conference for Kryptis, but the highlight was the march. Torchlight parades are an increasingly prominent nationalist gesture in Europe, but in some countries they are frowned on as jingoistic or even, with a frightening word, neo-Nazi. This was Kryptis' second march. Last year, the march was a wildcat celebration with no official recognition, but it attracted about 300 people. This year, Kryptis had government permission, and the march was led by a police vehicle and a large banner that read, Lithuania is here. And you can see just a sea of these very attractive the Lithuanian flags. There are three horizontal bars, yellow, green, and red. Kryptis shared sponsorship with a conservative Catholic organization, and the two groups prepared about 1,400 torches. All were taken and lit, and many people joined without torches. Kryptis was delighted with the turnout and expects many more participants in what will become an annual tradition. My hosts had invited foreign visitors to carry their own flags. Nationalists understand this is not a sign of disrespect to carry the flag of Flanders or Brittany or Wales in someone else's national parade. People who carry torches are part of a genuinely pan-European nationalism that recognizes the beauty of all European nations and regions. They share a passion for the preservation of all identities, and that's key to the identitarian movement. Key to the preservation of ourselves. And, you know, as I was suggesting earlier, when you can't get the basics right, when transgenderism, cross-dressing, becomes open and publicly acceptable, you're probably not able to get the more complex things, like the preservation of your people. Of all the flags in the world, I wonder which one I could carry with real commitment, not the one worn by the soldiers of regime change in Syria or Iraq, he means, you know, the U.S. flag. Not the one that's been irretrievably tarnished by diversity. I asked my hosts if they were to welcome a Confederate battle flag. They said that personally they would be delighted, but the foreign media would call it a symbol of racism. I carried only a small Lithuanian flag. One of hundreds a pretty girl was handing out. This was my first trip to Lithuania. Vilnius is a lovely European capital with a historical center of cobbled streets and handsome buildings. One of the first things any American racially conscious or not, will notice is how overwhelmingly white it is. I've been here 3 days and have seen only one non-European, an African, in my hotel. Vilnius is famously safe at all hours of the day, despite the masses of people in Cathedral Square. There were hardly any police. An American crowd of even one-tenth the size would have had to be protected from itself with huge armed forces. And rival gang members might still blaze away at each other. In Germany or France, the streets would have to be blocked off to keep Muslims from driving trucks into the crowd. In Vilnius, the only concern seemed to be supplying enough porta-potties. The Lithuanian police trust their people to be orderly, polite, and considerate. Isn't that a marked difference from what we see in so much of the West? I remember 1990 when Lithuania became the first of the Soviet republics to declare independence. I remember feeling very envious of Lithuanians. They were a united people in a nation reborn, with a real chance to forge a destiny. I was losing my nation, and they were building theirs. And that is, Jared's comment is so very sad and so very true, regrettably. The 20th century has been a horror for Lithuania. Dismemberment by Poland, invasions by Russians, and brutal Soviet occupation. But this century can be anything Lithuanians make of it. Not all is well, of course. The economy is booming, but wages are still low by European standards. Many Lithuanians are tempted by the flickering foolishness of Hollywood. Talented young people emigrate to Germany, Britain, or even Chicago, where there's a big Lithuanian community. Suicide and alcoholism rates are high. Birth rates are low. Lithuania is a member of the European Union, and there are bootlickers in government who think modernity means swallowing the multicultural poisons the UN peddles to its members. Their model is Merkel's Germany, not Viktor Orban's Hungary. Like all of Eastern Europe, Lithuania is at a crossroads. Will it be seduced by the glitz of the West? Will it adopt Western degeneracy, or will it remain true to its identity? Lithuania has survived centuries of partition, occupation, cultural obliteration, and repression, but it could be snuffed out by a few generations of immigration. Like all identitarian organizations, Kryptis vividly understands what is at stake. They are a band of brothers, native of the soil, fighting for their liberty with treasure, blood, and toil. Their struggle is our struggle. And that's Jared Taylor. A very, very eloquent and very moving report, and much food for thought. Much food for thought. Especially the grim observation that this beautiful thing, which has survived Lithuania, could be snuffed out in one generation. In several generations by mass immigration, but not to be for one moment cocksure about this. We are being snuffed out. The European founding settler people of the United States and Canada are being overwhelmed. And we will be a minority in the United States by 2041. That's 22 years. Math's not too good tonight from today. In Canada, a few years more, maybe just before 2050. All of that done, not because we lost a war, not because we were invaded, as Lithuania was, but by stealth and by policy, by immigration policy, put into place by, to be kind about it, fools, to be probably more accurate, traitors to their very core, traitors of their own people. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on White Resistance Radio .com. And speaking about self-hatred, here is an article that I largely agree with some caveats. It's Paul Craig Roberts, and the caveats put forth, not primarily by myself, but by others who have commented that it's very, very good, except that it glosses over or ignores the pernicious role of organized Jewry in promoting white guilt. Self-hating whites, says Paul Craig Roberts. White people are on the point of extinction. If you say anything about it, you're labeled a white supremacist. Black lives matter, but not white lives. For instance, in South Africa, where white farmers are being massacred under the slogan "Land or Death" by blacks whose forebears arrived in Africa after the forebears of the white farmers. This is often not known in much of the West. The line is that the whites stole the blacks' land and that Africa is black and therefore reserved for blacks. Whites are unwanted illegal immigrants. If the roles were reversed and it was whites massacring blacks, the white media in Western world would be shrill in its condemnation of the whites. As it is blacks massacring whites, there's not a peep. The only way you can learn about it is to read English language Russian internet sites. That's actually not the only way, but it's certainly the most reliable way. Only Russia has offered South African whites refuge. The U.S., Europe, and Canada are overflowing with non-white immigrants, but there's no room for white ones. Whites are on the road to extinction, not because of massacres by blacks, but because of their own tax, social, and immigration policies. In the U.S. and throughout Europe, high taxation has brought an end to single-earner families, such as the one that I and my generation grew up in. Wives have been forced out of the motherhood role into the earner role. Consequently, the white birth rate has dropped. The process of destruction has been helped along the way by feminism and abortion on demand. It's very difficult for a white person from one Western country to immigrate to another. An American who wishes to become, for example, a French citizen has to have a high income and a large French bank account and wait a long time. But a non-white can walk right in and take up residence without being evicted and expect to be supported by the French state. Except for Hungary, the same is true in much of the Western world. How did this topsy-turvy come about? Identity politics plays a major role. Identity politics, now institutionalized in Western universities and school systems as black studies and women's studies, teaches whites to be guilty for victimizing non-whites and teaches non-whites to hate whites for victimizing them. Instead of the former worker-capitalist class conflict, the conflict today is in gender and racial terms, and promoted by our own people to undermine our own self-confidence and self-value. And along the way to, and this is Paul Fromm commenting, not to Paul Craig Roberts, but along the way to almost incite resentment and entitlement among the chosen minorities. In Western countries where the white birth rate is collapsing and borders are open to non-white immigration, it's only a question of time before whites become a minority in their own countries. As the non-white immigrants are not being assimilated, Western civilization itself is on the road to extinction. Indeed, historical monuments are already being taken down because non-whites find them offensive. For example, in the American South, monuments to Confederate soldiers are being taken down. This is happening in southern cities that still have southern populations. And that shows how entrenched an ideology of identity politics has become. We see the same power of identity politics in Europe. Hungary has rejected the European Union's demand to open its borders to hordes of non-whites from Africa and the Middle East. Against the claim that declining white European populations mean that the countries will not be able to sustain their liberal, their social security systems without immigrants to support the tax base, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban offered to exempt mothers of four children from taxation. Orban's preference for Hungarians over non-white immigrants provoked a Swedish government minister, Annika Strandhäll, to equate Orban's call for more Hungarian children to the white supremacy of the 1930s. It was offensive, the Swedish minister declared, and reeked of the 1930s. Moreover, the minister declared it was an attack on feminism, which has freed women from bearing children and given them independence. The minister did not know there was the independence to go extinct. I think a very, very profound comment. Feminism has freed women. No, it's herded them into the workforce. Throughout Europe, especially in Germany and Scandinavia, there's pressure on the police and media not to report rapes of white women and other crimes committed by non-white immigrants. We shouldn't be surprised if Sweden passes a law making it a hate crime for a white woman to report her rape by a non-white. The very identity and ethnic awareness of whites is under assault. The Swedish national TV broadcaster, SVT, has produced a propaganda film under the guise of being a documentary. The film claims that Sweden was originally a country populated by blacks. In other words, the new influx is just returning to Sweden to normality. I mean, this is drool. This is historical and anthropological rubbish. Except for Hungary, there's no European government in power that represents white citizens. Merkel, for example, represents immigrants. Europe and Washington, but not Germans. Europeans do not even have enough of a survival consciousness to vote for nationalist parties to represent them. Marine Le Pen, who leads France's nationalist party, stands for France, and for this she is reviled. The French government wants to send her to prison for posting images from newspapers of people who were beheaded by Muslims. In other words, to present a fact that is unfavorable to a victim group is a hate crime. And I digress here, but the same in Canada, where in certain human rights cases, truth is no defense. Under certain provincial human rights codes, expressions that are likely to promote hatred or contempt for privileged minority groups. Likely, very, very hazy term, you know. There doesn't have to be any evidence that anybody was so moved by the statements that they felt rage or hatred or contempt. Or contempt. And contempt has been merely a negative feeling. And it's been ruled and approved by our own rascally cultural Marxist Supreme Court that truth in those cases is no defense. That is scary. From the point of view of Anglo-Saxon justice, it's an affront to our system. The entire purpose of Anglo-Saxon court hearings, the adversarial system, is to get at the truth and from the truth determine whether the charges are valid against the accused. And what do witnesses have to promise to do? Well, it used to be swear, but of course, as we are now peopled by many peoples who don't have the concept of swearing on the Bible, they now affirm, which means, well, you can take my word for it. What do they affirm to? They affirm to in the parlance of the court, to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. But truth matters. I may have told this story before, but I'm rather proud of it. I defended a good many of the victims of Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Code, which was the internet censorship section. And many of these prosecutions were initiated by a shadowy Ottawa lawyer named Richard Borman, who labors away in the bowels of the Department of National Defense, doing something or other, but seems to have plenty of time to persecute Canadians. Well, anyway, that law has been repealed. But in the bad old days when Section 13 was on the books and applied to the Internet, in one particular case, I was so frustrated at the very concept that truth would be no defense, that as the prosecution was about to swear in its first witness, I got up and objected. I said, well, I object. Well, what's your objection, Mr. Fraud? I object to the witness being asked to swear to tell the truth. Well, how can you object to that? I said, because if truth is no defense, what should it matter whether a person lies or not? I said, well, you sit down. But I was trying to make my point that in the alternative universe where truth is no defense, You're sailing into the rocks. Um, and going back to Paul Craig Roberts, instead of electing Le Pen, the suicidal French elected Macron, who hates France. French nationalism, declares Macron, is the betrayal of patriotism. Macron continues, patriotism is the exact opposite of nationalism. By putting ourselves first, we erase our nation's moral values. With his perversion of the meaning of patriotism, Macron subjects French men and women to the subjugation by both immigrants and the European Union. Although Merkel might be too careful to express it so clearly, her views are the same as Macron's. Thus it is that leaders of Europe's most important countries have abandoned their people. For Macron's view of France as a borderless and universalist country, read Fatherland and Nation by Scott Trask in the February 2019 issue of Chronicles. Western civilization is so far gone that Stephen Bannon, exiled from Washington and Breitbart News, has joined with others to form a new academy in Italy to train a school of gladiators capable of defending Western civilization from its internal enemies. Throughout the West, there are so many poisonous voices raised against the West that it will take hundreds of thousands of gladiators to stand them down. It might be too late. Many decades ago, Jean Raspail, this is actually in the early 1970s, in his novel, The Camp of the Saints, described the French government and media that welcomed the third world immigrants who overran France and extinguished the French nation. Today, Macron speaks exactly like the political characters in the novel. The situation is so far gone in France that it is not an exaggeration to say that the French people should be put on the list of endangered species. Wow. And he's absolutely right. And the critique of his article is that he ignores the pernicious role of many Jewish groups in helping bring this about. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Here's a very interesting series of observations by Diane Francis. Now, she's a long-standing columnist for the National, for the Financial Post, which has been incorporated into the National Post in Canada. Money laundering must be wiped out. Canada actually is notorious for money laundering, and she makes some very interesting points here. Of all the recent legal shenanigans in Ottawa, the failure to plug money laundering loopholes remains the most egregious. Here's the problem. Canadian cities rate highly among the most desirable in the world, but also among the most unaffordable, and it's not always been that way. Vancouver took the top spot for unaffordability in 2017, based on the gap between low incomes and high prices, according to a global survey. Toronto was the 13th most unaffordable, a major obstacle to attracting talent or head offices. I put it even more fundamentally, a major obstacle to children of the existing white population being able to buy homes in the city of their upbringing. That's what's happening in Vancouver, where whites are having, who grew up in Vancouver, unless they're very fortunate to immediately inherit their parents' or grandparents' home, or a very, very sizable chunk of money, you know, probably in the neighborhood of at least $500,000 to slap down as a down payment on a modest house, have to go far afield. Driven out of their own home, province, their own city. The culprit has been money laundering. By criminals, kleptocrats, and tax evaders. Their favorite means of hiding money is real estate. In 2018, Ontario and British Columbia imposed a 15% tax on non-resident buyers, resulting in a price drop in Vancouver in some housing prices. In the Toronto region, the average sale price of a home in 2018 fell slightly to $787,300 from 822,600 and change. It fell slightly, and that was largely because of the 15% on tax on non-resident buyers. Still excessive when taking income to pricing into account. Much more must be done by governments. The foreign buyer tax can be evaded easily because there are no transparency and disclosure requirements. Like, for one thing, the house could be put in the name of and most of the time it is by Chinese, and by a fellow Chinaman who actually is a resident of Vancouver. So it only cracks down on a little bit of the influx of foreign, very often corrupt money. Any corruption organization, Transparency International, offered a glimpse into the scale of foreign speculation abuse in 2015 with an analysis of Vancouver's 100 most valuable property deals. It found nearly 50% of ownership were hidden through shell companies, nominees, and trusts. No, in other words, the very pricey property was not sold to, let's say, Mr. Wong, which at least that might seem superficially straight up, but rather to a shell company or something else. The same likely applies in Toronto and Montreal, where money is parked in condos that are often left vacant. And that's true also in Vancouver, where huge mansions are left vacant. But adding to the, you know, taking more living space out of use. Statistics say the RCMP estimates up to $15 billion of laundered money enters Canada each year. That doesn't include laundering by crooks who also bury proceeds in real estate. What governments must do, according to the latest report by United Nations Financial Action Task Force, is crack down on money laundering enablers in Canada, that is, lawyers, real estate agents, notaries, and developers. Quote, requirements in Canada are inoperative in regards to legal counsels, legal firms, and in Quebec, notaries. In light of these professionals' key gatekeeper role, in particular in high-risk sectors and activities such as real estate transactions and the formation of corporations and trusts, this constitutes a serious impediment to Canada's efforts to fight money laundering or terrorist financing. Naturally, vested interests claim money laundering and foreign buying are minuscule. But if true, then why did taxes on a small percentage of foreign owners in British Columbia and Ontario, along with a ban on foreign buying in New Zealand, bring about price relief mostly on luxury properties? Now, in fact, establishment figures have for several years tried to downplay the amount of foreign money. Why? Because, well, it draws attention to corrupt forces who in some cases give them huge contributions, or in other cases it just draws attention to the immigration mess, and well, they don't want that. The disclosure of beneficial owners is a key solution. Otherwise, for example, real estate can be bought by a proxy person or company. Typically, funds come from a trust managed by a shell company, owned by another trust with an account in Luxembourg or Vanuatu, and managed by a Swiss or Singaporean banker who doesn't know the owner. Such arrangements must be illegal. The U.S. Treasury Department now requires beneficial ownership disclosure. Good suggestions. And she concludes with this. Where real estate prices have soared above affordable levels for locals, bans on foreign ownership should be imposed, as has been done in New Zealand, Hong Kong, Switzerland, Greece, Hungary, Denmark, Poland, and Malta, among others. Yeah, ownership of housing, which is key to a healthy society, has to be preserved and made affordable to normal people. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I'm going to take my musical break right now. And this is a really moving song by Keith Whitley and Lori Morgan, who at this point were married. This is over 20 years ago. Keith died very tragically, quite young, of alcoholism. And we're going to play this. This is Till a Tear Becomes a Rose.
Darling, I can see the clouds around you, and in your heart I know a sorrow. But if you weep, I'll be right here to hold you.
Delightful duet. Here's a song by Lori, A Picture of Me Without You.
Thank you. Sunday morning, with dawn church bells ringing, if you watch as the heart of a child breaks into, if you've seen a picture of me without you,
song by Patty Loveless.
Here, especially tonight for Porter Wagoner. I love you, darling. And I recall you doing this song, and then I recall you and Dolly doing it together as well. And they're for you.
This is not long before Porter Wagoner passed away. It was him.
If teardrops were me,
Patty Loveless. Gotta conclude my musical interlude here tonight with old country western sung by Patty Loveless, "Silver Threads and Golden Needles."
Song that I remember doing a long time ago when I was just a little kid, and I'm still doing it today. You guys ready to do this with me? Here we go.
This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All these are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf, forever.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Our fair dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot, and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours, which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home, the maple leaf forever.